This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
To sit next to me. It does take a village. So thank you for braving the road to come up here today. It has really been stormy and windy and wonderful. The hills will stay green for a little bit longer now. So I wanted to share something with all of you that doesn't get shared very often. And the reason that Nenzen Sensei and Shoho Sensei are sitting up here is that on the one hand, I could talk about this until the cows come home, but there also is this whole really important part about seeing it. And so I have invited the two of them, they don't know what I'm about to do, to take part in this thing that I'm going to do. It's a setup. And unfortunately, I would love to be able to do it with all of you, but there's just not that much time. So it turns out that both of these wonderful Dharma friends, teachers, have recently had a birthday. So I think that on top of it, this is like a nice little way to celebrate your birthday. So I will start though with the Dharma talk. When I was 7 years old, my parents suddenly got it into their heads that they should leave their hometown of birth in Jackson, Michigan, and move to Southern California. I was 7 years old at the time. My sister was 14. For her, it was devastating. For me, it was like, what? We're leaving grandma and grandpa? And what? My father came out first because he was in the heating and air conditioning business. Heating in Michigan is very important, but air conditioning in the 60s, that was big business. So he had two partners. He came out first, and then my mother drove four children from Michigan to Southern California. One of them was a year old baby by herself. That's where I come from. So fortunately, Southern California, despite other things that are not so great about it, has some very wonderful offerings. And one of the very best ones was that the Huntington Library and Gardens were about 20 minutes from my house. And in those days, you didn't need to make a reservation. And in fact, I don't remember ever having to pay for years. It was open, the Huntingtons opened it for free. So on Sundays, we would often go to the Huntington Gardens. But when you're 7 years old, a garden might not be particularly interesting, except one of the gardens there is a beautiful Japanese garden. And I remember the first time you have to go past the rose garden, and then you step through an archway, and there is this incredibly enormous temple bell with one of those, you know, really giant mallets. Of course, you wanted to do it, but you weren't allowed to. That would have made a big boom sound. And then you turn, and there's the garden in front of you. Exquisite. You go down a little bit of a slope. There's one of those crimson red half moon bridges. And then there is a creek. You go across a smaller bridge, and there's koi. And this little girl from Michigan had never seen koi. And then you go up some stairs back up, and there is this amazing, authentic Japanese house that was brought from Japan piece by piece and put back together by Japanese craftsmen here. When you get up to the house, so let's say the house, you're at this end. It's long and probably about as wide as this endo, maybe not quite that wide. So you're standing here and you're getting this complete view through the house, because they've opened all the shoji screens that would normally separate the rooms from each other. Yeah, like those. So they're all to the side. So you get this long, beautiful view of emptiness. It's all tatami mat floor. There's nothing in there. And my little girl is going, wow, I like this. So much space. Because my mother was a collector. Now, she collected very fine things, you know, Yadro sculptures and Waterford crystal. I mean, very high class stuff, but it was everywhere. There were rooms, particularly the living room, we were not allowed to be in unless company came, because we might break something, which I did on occasion. But here was just vast space. And all I could think of was, this is beautiful. Now, why my little seven-year-old thought that, I have no idea. But then, facing it, I see that there actually is something. Over here in this corner is this little cabinet. And next to it is a thing which I later found out was called a brazier. The big metal pot with the thing that holds the water on top is called the kama. So the cabinet's there, the brazier is next to it, and in front of it is a bowl. And inside that bowl is something made out of bamboo that kind of looks like a whisk. And something else, who knows, it's a piece of bamboo, what else that's for, and a little cloth. And I'm fascinated, and I see there's a little sign. And the sign says that this is for the tea ceremony. The tea ceremony. What's that? That was the beginning of a lifelong love for Japanese tea ceremony. Because after that, we would go back to the Huntington Gardens a lot, and that was always my first stop. Running past the roses to get to the Japanese garden, the rest of it, you know, great Huntington Gardens. The Huntington Library has Pinky and Blue Boy and a Gutenberg Bible. No, that was where I went. So fast forward, I arrive at my first Zen temple in 1984. I meet my teacher, and I'm there about a month when we're at breakfast one morning and somebody says something about having been to Japan and being able to attend a tea ceremony. I said, what? Oh, I have always wanted to be able to go to a tea ceremony. And my teacher very casually says, oh, well, we have someone in our sangha who teaches tea. What? Really? The following Thursday afternoon found me in Stanford University's sort of semi-ghetto at a long railroad-style house, those long, narrow houses. You stand at the front, you can see all the way to the back. This was the home of my to-be tea teacher, Peg Anderson. Peg would change her living room into a tea room by magic. She would take the grass mats that rolled up, she would put them down and pin them in place in her carpet. She had a little separator screen, and the brazier was sitting in front of it. And over by one end of her sofa was the tokonoma. So on the one hand, it was this old lady's house, and on the other, it was a complete tea room. Peg was 78 when I met her, and she was still sitting on the ground with a bench, but nevertheless, and I'm 71 now, and I think, how'd she do that? So that was the beginning of tea lessons. And I was like a fish in water. You're wondering, what does tea have to do with Zen practice? Everything. The way I think about our meditation practice is there's sort of three modalities. There's the sitting on your cushion when you are just following the breath and letting go of the thoughts that are arising and falling gently. No, you're not beating yourself up for it. You're just like, oh, I'm thinking again. All right, come back to the breath. And eventually the body settles down. And then because of that, the mind settles down. So that's your Zazen meditation practice on your cushion. And then there's this modality over here where you're going to leave today and you're going to go back out there and you're going to be driving along at 70 miles an hour and people are going to be behind you honking their horn. And that's when you're hoping that what happened in here stays with you long enough that you can just, you know, pull over to the side a little, let them go by. Oh, peace would be with you as they go by. There has to be something in between. All the Zen arts, all the forms that we do are that in-between place. When we're doing service, that's the in-between place. When I'm doing tea ceremony, or someone is doing calligraphy, or someone is arranging ikebana, or someone is weeding in a meditative way, that is the in-between place because you are both in meditation and in activity. I have found over the years that in-between place was the best thing I could do for the first modality and the third. It was a bridge between the two. So in tea, there are four principles, which could just as easily be four principles for Zen practice. Wa, which is harmony. Ke is respect. Se is purity. And jaku is equanimity or tranquility. These are the four principles that you serve tea and receive tea. And in tea, eventually the idea being, as in the Xin Xin Ming, not to. Although I am the host, and these will be my guests, eventually there is no host and there is no guest. There is just the tea. There is just the gift. That is something you can take into your daily life. Our problem is we're always separating. There's me and there's you, and no two ways about it, but it's not true. So the founder, the original founder of tea ceremony, took his cue from the monks in the monasteries who would be sitting all day long and all night long and realized that this thing called tea had caffeine in it. And that allowed them to sit longer. And eventually out of that ceremony of tea came the ceremony of orioki, which is the formal eating practice that we do here during sesshin, where you have three nested bowls, and then there's a cloth for your lap, there's a cloth for wiping, and there's a little container that holds your spoon and your chopsticks and the thing called a setsu, which is basically a spatula. And so you have all your bowls, you open them up, everything is self-contained, the food comes to you, it gets put in your bowl by your opposite number, or if you're in a really big zendo, someone actually walks around and serves you. You have to eat everything in your bowl, because if you don't, you get caught at the end, you're being served hot water to clean your bowl, oops, there's still food there. So the way to get around that is, first of all, you don't take too much. But then, after you've eaten, there's an opportunity to take your spatula and clean the last little bit out of your bowl. And then hot water comes and it gets poured into your bowl. And you use the spatula again and you clean it all out. You dry each bowl. You put it all back together. Voila, you're ready for the next meal. No dishes to wash. It's a really good system. The only dishes to wash are the ones up in the kitchen. So tea ceremony is related very much to Oriyoki. There is a definite sequence of events, and if you mess up the sequence of events, you're in big trouble. So I had this very kind tea teacher. I know of other tea teachers who weren't so kind. My friend Vicki Austin, her teacher, when she would make a mistake, would take her her fan and go, "Vicki-san, you should know better." I think I would not have done tea if I'd had that teacher. My teacher, though, when we would be doing the ceremony and we would come to a place and start to do something that, let's say, was in the wrong order, right? We were going to do something too soon, or we had to do something before we did that, all she would say was, "Not yet." That was her voice. I hear her voice completely. "Not yet." The great thing about "not yet" is that you know there's something going on that you should be paying attention to, but she's not saying "wrong," and she's also not telling you what it is. So you have to think about it for a moment. "Oh, I can't put the tea in yet because I haven't put the hot water in the bowl to heat it up." Oh. Which doesn't mean you still aren't going to make mistakes. She didn't do it for everything. Sometimes she would let you get to that point and you're going, "Oh dear." And you have to back up. But most of the time she was very kind. "Oh, no, not yet." So today, what I would like to do is tell you about Rikyu, who was the founder of our tea, the current modern tea, and give you his 7 instructions, because they are instructions for everything for us. So Rikyu was born in 1522, long time ago. And there are 3 schools that have descended from him, and they all carry his name. So he is Sen no Rikyu. No is just a combining word. It means pay attention to what's coming next. So Sen no Rikyu. So if you go to Kyoto, that's where the schools of tea are headquartered for Japanese tea. Ura Senkei is the largest school, and they are international. They are all over the world. Ura means front yard, so they're in the front yard. Omote Senkei is taught at places like Green Gulch up in the city, in Marin. And omote means backyard. I am from the little tiny school called Mushanakoje Senkei, which means little side yard. We are the smallest school. I don't even think we're international, other than here in Japan. My teacher, myself, and one other of my tea friends are the only people on the West Coast that teach this. And then there's a teacher in New York who I have never met. That's it. That's us. We are truly the little side yard. So one day, Rikyu, by the way, was the emperor's tea teacher. Now think about that for a moment. A tea teacher has to be willing to correct, possibly even criticize. You don't necessarily want to do that with the emperor, because if you say anything the emperor doesn't like, which is exactly what eventually did happen to Rikyu. Apparently, the emperor got upset with him later in life and off with his head. However, along the way, he was the emperor's teacher for tea. Now, if any of you know what a tea house looks like, when you enter, it's a 3 by 3 foot opening. It is the only example of democracy that I know of at that time, because whoever came for tea, then you had, if it was a samurai, you had to remove your swords. If it was the emperor, you had to remove your big hat. because there was no way to get in otherwise. Everybody had to bow their head, come in on their knees, bow in the room, and then have tea. So on this particular day, the emperor is invited to tea because he has found out that in the beautiful tea garden that is always associated with the tea house, Rikyu has an entire wall of morning glories, deep purple morning glories, and they are all in bloom. And the emperor wants to come and see this. So this is a great film that they made in, you know, reenactment. They've got the emperor coming down the road with all of his retainers. And, you know, he's looking very serious, and they get there and they start to walk into the garden, and he's looking around. The entire wall is just green. There isn't one morning glory. Now he's mad. He's come for the morning glory. He's about to give Rikyu a real taste of his tongue. So he takes off his swords and he takes off his big hat and all of the other accoutrements, and he the door, and he goes in and he looks up, because there in front of him in the tokonoma where the scroll is at the base is one perfect morning glory. Rikyu has cut all of the other morning glories off in order that the emperor's attention is completely on this one beautiful thing. Imagine how silly the emperor felt. I'm sure he didn't tell Rikyu that. Tea ceremony and our life are no different. We are surrounded by luxury, by overwhelm. And so we miss the one beautiful thing in front of us, which could be a person. It could be a flower. It could be a bowl of tea. So here are Rikyu's 7 instructions for tea. The first one, make a delicious bowl of tea. Check. They are about to have tea. So while we are waiting for me to make the tea, please help yourself. And you may go ahead and start. And the second is, lay the charcoal so that it heats the water. Well, I hate to tell you this, but no modern day tea person lays charcoal unless they have one of the traditional Japanese huts, because you're going to die of asphyxiation. So modern day tea people have an electric heater at the base. So in my version, it's lay the electric heater so that it heats the water properly. Now, this is a very important thing, turns out, more important than I actually thought. Because last October, I was at Hakone Gardens, part of a giant chakai, a big tea gathering, where hundreds of people come, and I serve, along with my one friend, 4 teas of, I think it's 12 people each time, so about 50 teas, right? Now, I only actually do what I'm going to do with them today for the first 2 guests, and then my assistants come in with a tray with bowls that they've already put together, because otherwise, again, we'd be there forever. However, okay, so on this day, the very first group of tea people come, and naturally, the first person is a Japanese tea teacher who always comes first. She must, I don't know, she gets some special dispensation, but she's always in the first guest position. I'm all ready. When we came the day before, we set everything up. We checked the brazier. The electrical has to come through a giant whatever. And it all worked. So I'm setting things out. We're going through. And I'm getting ready now to take the lid off the kama, which has the hot water. And I take it off. There's no steam coming out. So of course I have to school my face, oh, this is totally normal. And I very gently reach over my hand and it is lukewarm. So my friend who did a couple of the tea ceremonies is over on the side, which is what we did for each other. He comes over, it's like, John, something's wrong with the pressure. There doesn't need to be any intensity. Well, what we failed to understand, down below the gazebo where we served the tea was where we had it all set up to create the tea for everybody else. And there were heaters down there, you know, electric burners down there too. We blew a fuse because they were down there, but we hadn't checked that all out the day before, right? So there I am trying to figure out, all right, what are you going to do now? Because you still have to serve this person tea. I served her a bowl of lukewarm tea, which you are never supposed to do, but if I had waited for it to heat up, we would have been there for a half an hour. So in the meantime, John went and got a whole teapot full of hot water, and he came and afterwards, before I did the others, filled it back up with hot water, so it didn't take so long. But so Riku's second instruction turns out to be very important. Make sure that you don't blow a fuse. Okay. So the third one, which Taishin helped us with this morning, in summer, suggests coolness. In winter, warmth. What was the first thing I saw when I walked in? Was a wonderful fire laid in the wood stove so that we would all be very comfortable. The next one is also extremely important. Doesn't always work, as I just pointed out, but do everything in advance of the ceremony. Well, even the best laid plans, right? This one, though, I really love, and how appropriate. Prepare for rain. Check. I didn't know it was going to rain. I did this yesterday down in Santa Cruz and it was pouring. And how wonderful, what a great sound, right? And you know that because of the rain, everything is growing and the water is flowing in the creeks. But preparing for rain for tea means making sure that there are umbrellas available and that there's a place for people to sit out of the rain while they're waiting to come in and all those little details. But finally, and this is the one that applies to all of us for everything, give those with whom you find yourself every consideration. The world would be a lot better place if everyone gave everyone their complete consideration. So, I don't usually serve quite this way. Usually I'm on the mat and the tea things are in front of me. But for various reasons, because I'm way up here, I can't really lean over gracefully. I thought, oh, this is perfect. And it doesn't usually come in this little sweet package. I think it's backwards here. There it is. But like Orioki, you have your cloth cover, and voila, you have your tea things. Okay. So you're going to see a little bit of a tea ceremony. It's going to be a little less formal. For one thing, I don't have a brazier here, so I am going to be using a thermos. But it turns out that in Japan, when they're doing things like cherry blossom viewing, this is what they do. They have this. This is what holds the tea. I probably can't see it very well, but that's the green matcha. And for those of you who get matcha at Starbucks, shame on you, because you are hiking the price of matcha out of the ceiling. I had a container about half this size, $68. Now, granted, this is the best of the best. This is called Eju, and it is actually, there are three kinds of tea ceremonies. One is just a tray ceremony like this. Then, and still the tea though is Usacha, which means thin tea. And then for a very special, like a memorial or something, you do Kuicha, which is thicker tea. And everybody drinks from one bowl. And the trick about that is each one of you is supposed to take 3.5 sips. And if somebody screws up, the last person either gets nothing or they get way too much. So you kind of take your chances there. But the matcha that you get at Starbucks, that's very low grade stuff. But I want you to think about something. This is serious about tea in general. I'm not sure, coffee is probably similar, but with tea. When I was in Japan at a monastery, we went down to Kumamoto one day for begging practice. And I was astonished to see all these very old women bent over in half with their head like this because they could not straighten their bodies. This is because they had been picking tea their whole lives. And when you pick tea, the tea bush is 5 to 6 feet in diameter round. The reason it's round is that you come out every day and just the tiniest little green growing tip, the bright green, just like the tea. And you have a big basket, backpack. The basket's this big. All day long. Think of the labor when you drink your tea, because all tea comes from the same plant. So it doesn't actually matter whether it's green tea or oolong or black. All tea is labor intensive. So just hold that in your heart. So every tea bowl has a story, some more than others. This, by the way, is called a fukasa. This is part of the accoutrement of a tea teacher or a tea student. So the reason that I gave them a sweet, first of all, is that as I explained to my young children that I once a year do tea ceremony with at my former school that I finally retired from, every year I would do a Japanese tea ceremony. And they love the sweets because I always bring the good ones. Like this one had chocolate in it, right? This is because, as we explained to them, the moment you put something sweet in your mouth, you change your palate. So although the tea itself is a little bitter, both of their mouths are now sweetness. And so when they drink the tea, it will taste sweeter. Okay, so I'm going to begin. This is called a chakin. So this is the cloth that you wipe the bowl with. So the first thing, just like with English tea, that you want to do is you want to heat your bowl. But also, even though everything here is absolutely pure, remember say purity was one of the principles. Everything is perfect when I bring it in. Part of the ceremony is to show you over again that we're doing that. So the whisk, which by the way is made from one piece of bamboo, it's not exquisite, you know, that they just. So we look at the whisk to make sure that there's no broken edges because we don't want you to get bamboo in your tea. But of course, I knew there were no broken edges before I came. And then, just like in English tea, what you want to do, you want to make sure that your receptacle is warm. Because otherwise, when you add the hot water, then your tea won't be completely as hot as it should be. Now, this tea bowl has a wonderful story attached to it. I was given this one and one other one by the same person about 20 years ago. This bowl was made by a Vietnam vet who had terrible PTSD from the war. And when he was at the Veterans Administration Hospital back in New York, nothing his doctor tried worked to lessen his PTSD. Until one day the doctor said, you know what? I think you need to do something with your hands. So he sent him off to the OT department where he started working with clay. And it turned out that he had real facility with it. And he loved it. And it became a kind of meditation for him. And somehow, I don't actually know how, he wangled an invitation to go to Japan and study with a master potter, one of their national treasures. Somebody obviously had a connection. And so he ended up staying for years, 20 years. And this bowl is in a very particular style that you can find in any ceramics book on Japanese ceramics called chinoware. And if you look in the book, you will see it's the same glaze. It's the same heftiness. It is apparently also the same way the kiln. Now, most tea bowls have what's called a beauty spot. It's just a spot that's, you know, distinctive on the bowl. And when I'm making the tea, the beauty spot faces me. But what I love is that when I serve the tea, I turn it so that the beauty spot is now facing you. And when you drink, you hold it in your left hand with your right on the side, but you turn it two little turns to not drink from the beauty spot. But I often think that that is the way it is for us. That if we would only turn our beauty spot to the front, to each other. Because sometimes, you know, right? We don't turn our best self to a person. If we could remember, we all have a beauty spot. There's a place in us that is kind and generous and compassionate. Please. But sometimes we're not paying attention. And when you're working with little children, as I did for 30 years more, what you learn is if you're not paying attention, bad things happen. But I do remember one day I was checking out books. I was the librarian, which was a teaching job at this school. You read aloud to the kids like all day long, 5 days a week. And there was a little child. Yes, and you're allowed to, you actually are encouraged to admire the bowl and see how the foot is and all of that. Anyway, I'm checking out these books and finally I realize there's Mitha, kid with a big lisp. And I look down and he's been trying to get my attention while I've been busy. Finally, I turn my whole attention. What? I want a book on destruction. I bet you do. But if I hadn't finally heard him, I should have heard him sooner, but I didn't. But when I did, I finally turned my whole self to him to give him my attention. And he knew it. Actually, so do we. We know when people are just half-heartedly listening, half-heartedly participating. We know this. Or that someone's already thinking of what they're going to say while you're still talking. what they're going to answer, instead of really and truly, completely giving them your every consideration. So it's a good thing that we have this hot water, because these bowls were quite cold to begin with. So this bowl is a true tea bowl, except that it doesn't follow the rules about having a beauty spot. And this is because this bowl is actually Korean. My current tea teacher was a curator for the Asian Art Museum. And his specialty was Japanese and Korean ceramics. The problem is that when he went to Japan to be looking at the Japanese ceramics, apparently, and he was given connections to people to talk to. And finally, the person who was sort of taking him around said, you know, if you're going to continue doing this, you really need to take tea lessons, which meant that however he was handling stuff was not the right way. So again, he managed to get an invitation to start taking tea lessons with the person who is now currently the head of the Mushinokoji Senkei School, Mr. Sen. Everybody's Mr. Sen. It's passed on. But the current Mr. Sen is probably in his late 60s, and he was my teacher's teacher for 10 years before they let him into the treasure house. The treasure house is always at the back of the tea house, and it contains things from centuries ago. But you are only allowed to look at them if you know how to handle them. So this bowl, as I say, is Korean and highly patterned on the inside, which other bowls, Japanese bowls, are not. Japanese bowls tend to have. So this bowl has no pattern on the outside. So Ninzen is just going to have to figure out for herself where the beauty spot is, as I have to figure out for myself as the hostess. And that is also true. We don't always know where a person's beauty spot is, because we may think they don't have one. So part of our job as human beings and practitioners of the Dharma is to look for it, to know that maybe there's a part of them that is really irritating, provocative, mean-spirited, but we weren't born that way. Even the people you can think of that you really revile the most at this moment were not born that way. They were pure at some point in their life, which means it's still there somewhere. So Nenzen-san, take a good guess. So in a formal tea ceremony where there's a brazier and people are lined up, sort of, they would all be to my right in a row, there's a first guest. In this case, they are both my first guest. But in the tea ceremony, at this point, when everyone has had their tea, then I take the first tea bowl that I served to Shoho-san, and I warm it up again, just in case he might like a second bowl of tea. But he's not going to today. He is going to bow right now to let me know, thank you, that you do not need another bowl of tea, because if he says he wants another bowl, every guest gets a second bowl. I've never been at a tea ceremony where that was actually ever happened. I keep waiting. I think there's much, yeah. So actually hold it back out to them. Do you see those five dark marks? This is because the Korean style of doing the kiln, they stack All the bowls. And what you're seeing is the foot of the bowl that was on top of it. How that doesn't end up getting stuck, I don't know, maybe it does sometimes, but. Very good question. It's about, let me think, maybe 2.5 teaspoons of tea to 2 to 3 tablespoons of water. It's not a lot of water. I actually probably gave them a little more than normal. And it is meant to be able to be drunk in 3.5 sips. And one of the things that my young kids used to absolutely adore is that, so now I have to clean everything up, is that it's considered to be very polite on your last, the half sip, to go, that means you really liked it. And so, of course, the kids loved doing that. Yeah, so now I'm in the process of, I'm putting everything back together. Just like Oriyoki, you take it all apart, you do something, and then you put it all back together. There's a particular order in which you do things. And the fukusa goes back in your belt. And hopefully you get it the right way. It was the Chinese learned how to do the tea in the temple, right? Just the regular tea for the monks. And then there was a Chinese tea in which there would be lots of little cups, and they would pour the tea like this so that everybody got the same saturation. But this kind of tea ceremony was not until Japan. Yeah.
The tea itself.
Tea started in China. Yeah, there's an, I love this. When I do this tea choice with the kids, we're all over the world. We do tea from all over the world. But we also, we help them distinguish between green oolong and black tea so that by the time they're done with a 3-week course, we have a taste test and they can tell me which it is. And sometimes they can even tell me which one, like Darjeeling. Darjeeling is, let's see, but it was the English that did that. They brought the tea from China to India. Because
Darjeeling
is
high-quality Indian.
Because there are the three H's in tea: height, humidity, and heat. Darjeeling has the perfect combination of those three. You need enough rain, but you need enough heat, and you need enough height. So we could not grow tea here. It doesn't get cold enough, for instance, right? So it was the English who stole the rootstock of Chinese tea, because they were in charge of India at that point. Yeah, so they took it, they figured out, oh, Darjeeling, good place. Good, great business. Anyway, yes, there's a whole history of all of that, but there's an apocryphal beginning of Chinese tea, which is that the emperor was sitting near a tea bush, a tall tea bush, and he was drinking hot water because, according to this, even then they understood that hot water was, you know, better for you than cold water because of bacteria. And a tea leaf dropped into his hot water. And therein started the tradition of tea. Yeah, it's great. It's an apocryphal story. So the last thing I want to show you, thank you, Emperor, exactly. Well, of course, it had to be the Emperor, right?
Couldn't be a
commoner, right? No, who probably had the same experience, but. So the last story I want to share, and I've shared this before, but I've never shared the bowl. Probably after 10 years of studying with my teacher, my tea teacher, came a day when it was just me there as a student and her as teacher. And that happened on occasions that I wouldn't be the only, I was there every Thursday afternoon without fail. But sometimes other students didn't show up. So on this day, I'm the only person. We've had tea, and this bowl is 300 years old. And because it's so shallow, you can imagine that when you're trying to make the tea, centrifugal force wants it to go out. So what Peg would do instead would she would serve the little sweets, and there'd be a pair of chopsticks, and you'd come in with it and turn it very ceremonially and set it down in front of your first guest, and then they pass it on. Okay, so on this day, she had in fact used this bowl for the sweets. And so when you're undoing everything, the last, I would be getting up and walking things in and out if I were in a true tea ceremony. The first thing that you would take out, because it's waiting for you, is the tray, the bowl that has the sweets and the chopsticks. And so you put it to one side, you make your final bow, thank you for coming to tea, you pick it up, and you go out into the mizuya, the kitchen. So Peg's kitchen, very old, like I said, railroad style house, long and narrow. On the one side, double-sized steel sink, no divider. And Peg believed that the water in the kama, remember the thing on top of the brazier that's holding the water, because it was in an iron pot, she believed it was very good for health. So she didn't want us to throw away that water. She had a regular tea kettle on her stove, and you would put it down in the sink. And the kama has these two rings that you put in so that you can turn the whole thing over, even though it weighs a lot, right? Because you can't touch it because it's hot. So you use the rings and you pour the water in. It was always a little bit tricky, but you know, we managed to get most of the water into her teapot. So on this day, though, I bring this bowl out and I put it in this corner of the double steel sink on the sink. And then I bring out the kama with the two iron rings, and there was a small area here and then the wall, and I set it right here so that I could then put the teapot down there. And so the teapot went up here. There's a lid, a round metal lid on the top of the kama. So I had taken that off. Okay, so imagine, trying to think how to do this. Here's the sink. Okay, you got these four sides. The bowl is down here, this bowl. The kama is over here, and that lid is right here on the edge. So I reach over to get the two rings to start turning this over. I have to guess this is what happened. I actually don't know. Somehow when I did that, I pushed the round metal lid into the sink. And instead of it going like that, which is what you would expect, it fell over onto its side and it rolled. Think. And all of a sudden, there were two little tiny chips in the sink. I have just broken my teacher's 300-year-old tea bowl. I was horrified. I was frozen. I didn't really know what to do in that moment. It was just, I couldn't believe it, that it had happened, because you know, it's like if you've ever been in an accident, a car accident, everything goes into slow motion. It was exactly like that. I'm sure it went dun, dun, but for me, it was la, 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 la. And here it is, right here, the end of her beautiful antique 300-year-old tea bowl. I'm her senior student, and I'm like, oh my God. I have to go out there back into the living room and tell her I've just broken her bowl. I have to admit, the first thought that came into my mind, this is terrible, I thought to myself, and there's no one else to blame. Because I'm the only student there. I can't even say someone shouldn't have left it in the sink. But meanwhile, I have to go back to my 87-year-old teacher who's sitting all waiting for me to come back out to tell her what I have done. It took my every piece of practice and willpower, because I thought, what's going to happen? I was already 5 miles down the road. She's going to cry. She's going to yell at me. She's going to tell me, how can I have such a terrible, careless student never come back? You have to understand, I'd been working with her for 10 years. We loved each other. We were close, very close. So I finally steeled myself. And I walked in. I said, Peg, I've just done something really terrible. And just broke your bowl. And, you know, I've mended things for you before, and I'm sure I can fix it partly, but I also know it'll never be perfect again. I am so sorry. So I handed her the bowl. She's sitting in a chair, and she takes the bowl. Meanwhile, I am dying a thousand deaths standing next to her, wanting to be anywhere but there, waiting for the axe to fall. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I know that in the past, when I would break something valuable of my mother's. But she keeps looking at it. It's like, what is she looking at? And finally, after what seemed like 30 minutes to me, which was probably one, she looks up at me and she says, well, these things happen. These things happen? Well, of course they do. But what? That's your response? And she handed the bowl back to me. That was a turning point in my life. Because for the first time, other than maybe my husband, someone absolutely expressed unconditional love, unconditional acceptance of me in all my mess, in all my flaws, in all my carelessness. She chose me over her bowl. And you're thinking, well, of course, the bowl's just a thing. Well, yes. But I really don't know very many people who would have responded that way. Mostly, they would have gotten upset. They would have probably said some mean things. They might have even apologized for getting angry later, but nevertheless, the harm would get done. The separation would have happened. The other thing she didn't do was try to make me feel better about it. She didn't say, oh, it's okay, Misha, that you just broke my 300-year-old bowl. All she did was say, these things happen. And that is the true reality of life. Things happen. And a lot of them are not nice. A lot of them are terrible and horrifying, and you're going to be grieving the rest of your life over them. No praise, no blame. I don't know what was going through her head while she sat there looking at herself in the bowl. There's a part of the tea ceremony when you're using a ladle. The ladle is a round piece of bamboo, and you turn it and you look into it deeply. It's the enso, it's the circle, right? It's the same thing here. That's what she was looking at that. And she grounded herself She settled herself in her equanimity. Remember the fourth principle of tea? She had been practicing tea since she was 40. She grounded herself in her practice. And when she did that and emptied her mind of all of those blaming or praising or upset, what arose for her was clarity, compassion, and generosity. We forget to take the time. Because what she could have done, most people, you broke my bowl? What? Well, look at that. What are you going to do about that? She just took the bowl from me. She didn't say anything. And then she just, while she was settling herself, she looked long and deep. And that is what arose in her to say. One of our biggest difficulties is we are all going way too fast in everything. We come here to sit in order to settle the self on the self, in order to stop going so fast, in order that when you leave here today, maybe you don't drive home so quickly as you drove here. Maybe you take the time to see the broom that's in bloom, or to see the shape of the oak trees as they're arching over skyline. Or, as I say, to let the person who is in the very big hurry go around you and wish them well. That is what tea has to do with Zen practice. Someday I would like to serve tea to all of you so that you could experience just the calm and the respect and the harmony that gets created in this simple act. It's not like drinking an English cup of tea where you pour your tea and you drink it and you're talking and all. There's not a lot of talking usually going on other than about the weather. You're allowed to talk about the weather. No politics. Even if you're the emperor, you are not allowed to talk about the clan that you're upset with. You ask about the morning glory. Thank you. And thank you who joined online. So I'm probably way over time. But maybe if, like, two questions, if somebody had a question, something they wanted to know, ask, now's the time. Don't be shy. Yes, Rain.
And had so much emotion.
It comes up even now. Now it is, Rain, that is one of the things that I find most amazing. I can bring up, if I was angry with someone 15 years ago and I start thinking about it, I can start feeling angry about it again, which is stupid, right? It's done, it's over. But in this case, I'm glad because I that moment of going back into the living room and standing next to her is emblazoned in my heart. I will never forget the sound of her voice. Not yet is wonderful, but these things happen. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, you and me.
I just want to say that really important all that sense of calm.
Yeah.
Sense. And maybe.
Right.
But in the mental, very mysterious and beautiful.
Here we are. It's true. No, that's yours, actually. I forgot. I had to go into the Chidin room and get it. Yeah, it's mysterious. It actually is mysterious how all of this happens. As I said, I can't do this. It's Oryokin. For some reason, I just can't do it. Here it is. It goes the other way. Okay. I started to. Thank you. I'm so emotional. I can't even do this. I started tea literally a month after I started my Zen practice. And as I say, my tea teachers are very casually, oh, we have a Sangha member who does tea, right? Like it was nothing, like it wasn't important. And he never thought it was. He never actually understood that this was a Zen practice from my point of view, but Peg knew. But I was there with her maybe a month, maybe so four times, when she says to me, well, you know, you really should be studying with Kobun, who was up here. My teacher was at the original temple that helped to start this one down in Mountain View. But I had literally just asked my teacher to be my teacher. So it's like, well, I don't think I can go back and say, well, guess what? I've changed my mind, you know. But Kobun's influence on Peg was palpable. The way she was with me is the way I assume Kobun was with her. Kind, not too directive, right? Open, very open, you know, not worried about, I mean, my teacher did not have a certificate. But when Suzuki Roshi came to have tea with her, and also when the Mr. Sen, the head of the school, came to have tea with her, they both said, you need to be teaching tea. And she said, oh, but I don't have a certificate. And they said, it doesn't matter. You have the heart of tea. And then Suzuki Roshi said, and you need to charge for it. Because he said, you know, Americans don't value things they don't pay for. Anyway, Kobun was Peg's teacher. But the problem was that my teacher and Kobun had some difficulty. And so even though I live 20 minutes down the road, it wasn't until this fine young gentleman invited me to come and give some guest lectures that I started coming back to Jikoji. And what an unfortunate thing for me not to have been here long before. But eventually my group came and did a few sesshin here, got to know the land a little bit. And then when Nenzin Sensei came along, she says, so Mike, who do you invite to give guest talks? And he mentions my name, and we like just hit it off completely. And so last year, Choho-san and Nenzin-san invited me to become a teacher in Kobun Shino's language. And I had been coming as a guest teacher, and I said, well, why would we do that? You know, you have me. I'm here. I'm yours. And Nenzin said the only thing that would have made a difference. We want you to be part of our family. And they are perfectly complementary. And I feel like Peg is somewhere out there going, these things happen.
That was a good cup of tea.
That was a great cup of tea.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.